Chapter 50. Ruth. 9:55 p.m., November 22, 2018. Thanksgiving Eve. Ruth sat at a red light on Atlantic Avenue in a black Mercedes, a lit cigarette between the fingers of her left hand. The window cracked open an inch to let the smoke out. She checked her dye job in the mirror. 4 hours in a salon and $400 later, she was now a redhead. An Ed Sheeran track played on the radio. Ruth liked to keep up with new music, and she enjoyed the beat of this one. The fingers of her right hand tapped out the rhythm on the steering wheel. She took a drag from her cigarette, waited for an update on the news at the top of the hour. Her thoughts drifted to Amanda. What she must be feeling right now. Cheated, conned, angry, all of those things. And none of it mattered. Amanda would not go to the police to give herself up, and even if she did, there was no evidence to back up her story. Naomi was gone. She'd never even existed. She took another hit from her cigarette. The traffic light was still red against the night sky. The news came in at the top of the hour. Quinn was still alive, but critical. With luck, he would die soon. She had that feeling again, relief. She was reborn, free from fear. She'd first experienced that feeling 11 years ago. That hour she'd spent walking along Park Terrace in Frog Hollow, Hartford, after Scott had told her he'd killed Travers. She remembered the smell from the grass, going grocery shopping, buying that coffee, just walking the streets without fear. And the light. In her memory, that time had been during the golden hour, or what some called the magic hour. The period of time right before sunrise, when the sky and the light is a mix of burnished bronze and gold. It gives every surface a Midas touch. Puddles of rainwater on the sidewalk turn into pools of gold. Stop signs look like 24-karat treasures lifted from a pharaoh's tomb. And in the distance, she could hear a brass bell ringing softly. It hadn't really looked like this that day, all those years ago. She knew that. It didn't matter, not really. The warmth, the sheer relief, and the sense of comfort she'd felt that morning had bled into her memory, painting it in shimmering gold. The bad things that had happened later that day were not so clear in her mind. They had blurred and dulled with time and heavy medication. She scanned the road ahead, a gas station just beyond the intersection with Brooklyn Avenue. She would go there, fill up on gas and Lucky Strikes, a small thing, something that people do every day. And she could do it tonight without fear. Mr. Blue Eyes, as she had come to know him, was gone. He lay fighting for his life in a New York hospital bed. He wouldn't be waiting, hiding in the back seat of her car when she returned from the gas station. He wouldn't be waiting for her later while she lay awake in bed. His face would not haunt her dreams. She could live and sleep in that golden haze again. A horn blasted behind her. She glanced in the rearview mirror. The driver in the car behind was gesticulating for Ruth to move on. The light was green. She put the car in gear and moved off slowly, turning into the gas station. She got out of the car, pumped gas into the tank, and looked around while it filled. A run-down neighborhood in Brooklyn. The elevated train tracks ran down the center of Atlantic Avenue, carrying people in and out of Manhattan. She went inside the gas station, bought 4 packs of Luckies, and paid in cash for the cigarettes and gas. It felt good. The small things always did. To live an ordinary life without fear was something marvelous to her, and always would be. Back in the car, she checked her destination on the navigation system. She was close now. 15 minutes later, Ruth parked the car in the long-term parking lot, got her bag and her case from the trunk, and took an Uber to her new apartment. The movers had been there yesterday, and when she entered the apartment, the furniture had already been laid out, boxes opened, cutlery, plates, and mugs put away, and her bed made. It was an expensive service, but she could afford it. The house sale gave her a lot of ready cash. She needed it. New York was an expensive place to live, and it wasn't like she could work, not with everything else going on. She showered and then got into bed, the fresh cotton sheets cool and welcoming. It was Thanksgiving tomorrow. She'd decided she would go to the parade. It would be safe. Ruth closed her eyes and tried to empty her mind. Thoughts tended to cloud her peace. The certain knowledge of Quinn's incapacity allowed a sense of calm to flow through her entire body. She didn't need to think, she just felt it. Thinking didn't help. It was all about feeling, that feeling. Sometimes, in the dark, she would hear chains rattling. She knew it wasn't real, it was imagined, a box in Ruth's mind, a result of her EMDR therapy with Dr. Marin. He had told her it was the best way to deal with trauma. Eye movement desensitization and reprocessing therapy at Kirby Forensic Psychiatric Center. Dr. Marin was in his late 50s when they first met. He wore a beard and a ribbon of fluffy white hair surrounded his head, never encroaching on the shiny dome on top. They met in a sterile treatment room, table and chairs bolted to the floor, and Marin in his white coat, a little yellowed with age at the cuffs, sat opposite her with his fingers clasped together over his belly. He had a kind voice, soothing.
"Give me your hand," he said.
Ruth held out her hand over the table. Gently, Marin took it and began to tap on the back of her wrist.
"I want you to imagine a box you can open and close,"
he said, as he tapped softly on her wrist with his forefinger.
"It is strong, this box, very strong. If you put something in there and locked it, no one could open it but you. It is your box. See it now, clearly, in your mind."
She closed her eyes. Tap, tap. He asked her to describe the box, and she did.
"We are going to put things in this box, Ruth. It is your box for your things. We will talk about the things we put in the box. We can put anything in there. A person, a place, a dream."
He tailed off, tapped again, and said,
"Even a face."
Ruth saw him then, reflected in the broken glass, the man who'd hurt her. His voice sounded in her head.
"Hello, sweetheart."
She flinched, and Marin's grip on her hand tightened.
"Can we put a voice in the box?" asked Ruth.
"Yes, anything you like. First, we make the box strong, stronger than anything. Then, when you're ready, we will look at the things that frighten us the most. We will make them smaller, shrink them, and we will put them all in your box. And then you will be safe from them. They won't be able to hurt you, and they will never be able to leave that box again."
Tap, tap. Ruth lay in bed in her new apartment, Marin's voice in her head as she tapped her own wrist now and thought about the box. Heavy chains were wrapped around the old oak chest in Ruth's mind. She could see the brass edging on the chest's corners and the third lock keeping its contents secure. The lock and the heavy anchor chains were not for keeping people out. They had a different purpose. They were in place to make sure what was in the chest did not escape. Now and again, in the dark, or in the nightmare place between waking and sleep, she heard the chains groaning, rattling, as the things inside the box strained to get out. She could hear them now. The noise was growing louder. Ruth sat up in bed, tapped on her right wrist with her left forefinger, rhythmically, slowly, every 2 seconds. While she tapped, she looked at the metronome on the side table, allowing her eyes to follow the ticking needle, back and forth. Tick, tock. She tapped her wrist to that beat. She knew what was in the box, struggling to get out. The blue-eyed man was in there. All the blue-eyed men were in there. She tapped, breathed, and put more chains around the oak chest. 20 minutes later, the chains had stopped rattling. Ruth took a sip of water and shook her head. She should not be feeling this way. This was different from the last time. The sense of calm and power that normally followed the kill was not there tonight. The warmth of peace had diminished. Already, she could feel a presence outside. Somewhere in the city, Mr. Blue Eyes was alive and hunting her. She could sense him, those blue eyes searching for her. A chill brushed her neck and shoulders, causing her to shiver. Ruth got out of bed and checked the windows. One of them was open. She closed it and scanned the street below. No one there. She went to her bag, emptied it onto the bed. 5 cell phones, all of them connected to remote chargers. All 5 phones held messages for her, some on text, some on WhatsApp. The messages were not for Ruth, of course, not really. They were for Jenny, Rachel, Simone, Amy, and Sarah, her current identities, 5 in all. Most of them were members of 2 or 3 support groups. All of the identities looked like Ruth, and all of them were grieving and bitter and angry at a lost love who had been cruelly taken from them by a killer. To help organize her various live identities, Ruth had stuck name tags to the back of the phones. Otherwise, she would lose track. Jenny, for example, was in 2 online support groups for bereaved parents. Rachel had a trauma group meeting on Thursday afternoons in Harlem. Simone in Queens on Tuesdays. Amy's groups were further apart, East Flatbush and Staten Island. Sarah was the busiest, 4 online groups and 2 physical, Wakefield in the Bronx and Bedford-Stuyvesant in Brooklyn. There were almost 8.5 million people in New York, and population density varied between 20,000 and 60,000 people per square mile, a perfect place for Ruth to hide. She was a red needle in a haystack of 8 million. With all of the groups, she sought out the same kind of person, a parent, a husband, a wife, a lover, who had lost a loved one to someone who had not paid the price. Sometimes they were hard to find. Other times, they were in the groups already, just waiting for her. All she had to do was tease them out. Injustice and grief were her weapons, molded from love, regret, and sometimes even guilt. A few of her targets were already primed, ready, waiting. All she had to do was tell them the story of 2 strangers on a train. She decided that in the morning, she would go back into Manhattan, into the street she knew so well. Tomorrow was the parade. She could watch it and try to enjoy it. The peace that came after the kill was fragile and precious. She needed to grasp it, bask in it, while she could. It was dwindling already. Ruth replied to the messages on the phones, turned them all off, and went to sleep.